Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Stay the course! We are dead! We are all dead!
We were supposed to make the world a better place. What happened?
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
I know Kung Fu.
You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not gonna take this anymore!
This whole thing is insane!
300 years ago, you'd have been burned at the stake.
What do all men with power want? More power.
This is now the United States of Zombie Land.
This whole thing is insane!
Man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction!
Everybody is stuck with the things that they're not proud of.
More power.
Welcome to the desert. Of the real.
More power.
There can be only one.
Are you a God-fearing man, Senator? That's such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher, as a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really are afraid of is me.
Happy heresies, and welcome to the desert of the real. Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is. Especially with the latest AB Live audio version for thee in this eternal now and in this Red Pill cafeteria. Robert Price materialized at the virtual Alexandria to discuss his new book, The Gospels Behind the Gospels. Much of the work focuses on early Christianity's underground and bubbling stream of Gnostic thought. That's what we'll concentrate on, finding the pre-Christian origins of Gnosticism, the Demiurge and why there is evil, and the secrets of various Gnostic Gospels. We verge into similar concepts like mystery religions, the rising and dying God-men, and ancient novels. Hide your daughters of orthodoxy. We need Gnosis more than ever, needless to say, in this age of Hermes, Philip K. Dick world, and Gnostic times. The collective and personal human consciousness is collapsing, and only the fire of Prometheus and the breath of Sophia will save us. You won't find this high-quality Gnostic and Hermetic wisdom, or many of my guests and their unique insights, anywhere else in cyberspace or even meat space. So please support in any way you can. One way to support, which actually provides you with incredible educational material, is to join the virtual Alexandria Academy. I've recently added the lesson, The Characteristics of Mary Magdalene. See Mary in her full impact and Gnostic majesty. Have you ever wondered what it means to be a Gnostic? Explore the depths of ancient knowledge with our exclusive online course on Gnosticism and learn at your own pace. Immerse yourself in the mysteries of the ancient world and uncover secrets never revealed before. And don't forget my voiceover availability for any podcast, commercial, audiobook, documentary, or whatevs. I'll bring you stellar results with down-to-home professionalism. And don't forget, I do have an Amazon wishlist and a fantastic merch store. Other than that, let us to our latest AB Live. The Empire Never Ended.
Thank you. I love you. You're my little buddy. Okay, let's watch some interdimensional cable.
Do So you're saying my father and his kingdom?
Well, yes. It's based on the fusion of a Sumerian god named Yah and a Mesopotamian god named Wei.
And we're in a toy train?
Yes. It's enough to really make you question all of existence, isn't it? So what do you think you're going to do about it?
I'm going to do what I've always done. I'm going to get the fuck out of here.
Father of omens! Give me blood beyond sight!
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to AB Live. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your Pompidus of Gnosis. Glad to see everybody. Glad you could join us on this Saturn day. And yes, people are definitely already joining into the chat room. Great to see everybody. And we have a very exciting show, as always, when we are joined by the Bible geek, Robert M. Price. So, Bob, how are things doing? How is your battle against the priests of the Temple of Syrinx?
Oh, doing well as far as I know, but of course I guess these things are always done on a higher and invisible plane, so one just has to keep one's fingers crossed, hoping you're winning.
Good, yeah, keep those Archon passwords in your back pocket so you can whip them out and use them when it comes. Awesome, well, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your book, The Gospels Behind the Gospels, and a lot of good Gnostic goody-goody, so we want to focus on that. And with us, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, happy to be here with the Superman of the Septuagint. I heard that latest Bible Geek with all the superheroes. So that was great. Good to see you, Bob.
Glad to be here too.
Awesome. Yeah, and you posted on Facebook you saw the new Ant-Man movie and you gave it a good review, huh?
Yeah. I was surprised to hear from somebody else that the reviews are really tearing it down. I'm quite mystified at that. I wonder what really? They expected.
No idea. I'll have to check it out for myself when the time's up. So,
yeah, maybe they want a Roach Man to appear or something.
Yeah, probably will in the next one or something. Actually, they had sort of implied that this next one would involve Bill Foster, played by Lawrence Fishburne, as I remember, in the second one. He was to... In the comics, he becomes the Black Goliath, and he takes over that role once Henry Pym becomes Yellow Jacket, and which he doesn't in this, obviously, though they do have a Yellow Jacket character in the first movie, but they didn't touch that one, but it certainly follows up big themes from... the Avengers Endgame movie and all that stuff about the quantum field. And I thought they did a really fascinating job with that.
So Morpheus has moved on to another job. Glad to see him getting work.
From the red pill and black pill to the black flag.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the Pym particles, as they call
it. Yeah, that is funny how, in the comic books, isn't it Henry Pym who creates Ultron? It's not Iron Man.
That's right. My daughter, Victoria, cannot forgive them for changing that. Actually, I think it makes more sense that Tony Stark would have created Ultron than Henry Pym, but that is the... As some folks really don't like what they do with MODOK in this movie. But what the heck? I mean, how many movies are they going to make? If you want to have more of the characters, whether heroes or villains, you have to introduce them obliquely in a different setting than they first appeared. And so it's no surprise to me.
Yeah, no big deal. I mean, I was watching the second Black Panther movie and made me laugh because sometimes they forget you've got the Siri or I forget the girl who becomes the Black Panther. She's working with all this AI and the Queen Mother is like, don't mess with that. And she's like, oh, AI is fine. We will control it. No problem. I'm like, did you guys forget about Ultron a few years
ago? Yeah.
It's already established that AI is bad in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but they forgot about it in Wakanda. So sometimes they need to do some fact-checking on their own dialogue and screenplays. But anyway, why don't we talk about an even better, a just as imaginative screenplay, and that is the New Testament. So you say, tell us about why you wrote this book. You said you had to think of it as what, a Viewmaster toy, an exercise in speculation box?
Yeah, where there's an image behind an image, and you have to see them both together to get some idea of the three-dimensionality of the original. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do here. I know, of course, that the present canonical gospels are not promoting a whole bunch of different Christologies at the same time, but it looks like they're presupposing a bunch of them. That while you could say that barely they're not incompatible, it seems to me that they are. I mean, somebody has tried to harmonize a bunch of views of Christ that really point in very different directions. Why would that be? And so I'm engaging in the thought experiment that the gospel writers, as we know them, were using sources, each of which promoted consistently one or another of views of Jesus that are mentioned in the Gospels. And at least we're told at the Caesarea Philippi confession scene with Peter that there are competing opinions of who Jesus is. Some say the returned Elijah, some say one of the prophets, and in John, it's narrowed down to the prophet, the prophet, like Moses in Deuteronomy, or John the Baptist raised from the dead, and then there are others, but it seemed to me for a long time that means Mark knows, whoever he was, that he knows of Christians that understand Jesus to be Elijah, not the Messiah, or the Davidic Messiah, though there's an opposition to that eventually, even in Mark, or that he is Moses or one of these prophets, or is he the king of Israel, and so on? Or why does he teach in parables? He only wants the elite to understand him. That doesn't fit the Davidic Messiah or any of the others. He's some kind of Gnostic mystagogue, and so on. And so it seems to me, did somebody certainly had a coherent view of who Jesus was, and apparently several somebodies did. And when the gospel writers decided to compile their books, they took all sorts of Jesus material floating around from these different groups and just sort of tossed them all in. And it's so apparent to me that it's not that difficult to disentangle them and to say, look, here is material that that must have come from a group that thought Jesus was the prophet like Moses. Others, like when Jesus gives the Sermon on the Mount and from a mountain, right, like Sinai, and his face later in the Transfiguration glows like the sun, like old Mo, that the teaching of Jesus are placed into five sections. What does that tell you? Or the central section of Luke, the travel narrative, as it's been demonstrated really beyond doubt, that is like a second Deuteronomy, or as I call it, a Deuteronomy. Why would you go to that kind of trouble in either case, unless you thought this guy is the new Moses, if not Moses returned, as some Samaritans thought? Or how about these lists of miracles, like three different versions, two in Mark, one in John, have Jesus do a series of miracles, and at the end of John, it says, well, of course, Jesus did all kinds of stuff. I wouldn't have the room to cover them all, but I have chosen these to get you to believe that Jesus was the Christ. Well, who expected the Christ to do all of these particular things? They sound more like Elijah and Elisha. And there were people, Mark tells us, who thought Jesus was Elijah. Then why is there material about John the Baptist in Luke, for instance? It so clearly parallels the nativity of Jesus and that of Samuel. We have a martyrdom story of John the Baptist that in some respects is strikingly parallel to that of Jesus, even to the point of the tyrant's wife getting involved. I mean, why would that be? And then there's this resurrection kerygma of John the Baptist, where they're saying John the Baptist is raised from the dead, and that's why miraculous powers are at work in him. That sounds an awful lot like in Romans chapter 1, that Jesus, according to the flesh, son of David, but according to the spirit of holiness, he's designated the Son of God by an act of power, dunamis, the same word. And then what do we hear? In Mark, twice, people are saying, this Jesus guy, he must be John the Baptist raised from the dead. Well, there you go. Like you've got, and we know from the Mandeans and so on that people believe that John was the Messiah. Were they talking about the same guy originally? And then what about these weird bits where Jesus tells the disciples everybody got a sword here because you're going to need it soon. Huh? The kingdom of God advances with violence and violent men take it by force. And he's got disciples, the zealot, the Bar Jonah, the terrorist, and so on and so on. What is that? And he's crucified by Rome as a seditionist, the man who would be king. Mm-hmm. Was that all just a mistake? Intelligence community saying that Trump is a Russian stooge and it was all a hoax? Somebody thought that. And that it wasn't a bad thing. And so I just said, okay, let's put them in the relevant columns. And you have a bunch of stuff that would make the most sense as a Christology, quote unquote, unto itself. And somehow it's all been scrambled and thrown into four blenders. Now I don't know that happened. And as far as I know, nobody else suggests it because there's this lingering idea of one Lord, one faith, one baptism. And, like Christianity always must have been the singular thing. I once asked Bert and Mac, aren't you implying with your talk about Jesus movements, plural, and Christ cults, that there was no single root of Christianity, but that things grew together? And he says, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And so I figured, well, let's take that for a test drive and see. So this is just like a kind of a hypothesis, a proposed paradigm. I'm sure most people that read this are going to think I'm nuts. And I agree, there are problems with it, but boy, does it make new sense of a bunch of stuff. So there's my possible theory.
Yeah, it works in the book. It's like that Dire Straits song, Industrial Disease. Two men say they're Jesus. One of them must be right. But oh, good song. If you check it out, good album. But yeah, for the audience, if you have any questions for Bob, please lots of question marks, caps, or just super chat them. And Vance will do his best to be the scribe to get your question with us. But we were just talking about comic book movies. Can we make the sort of the same analogy? Like, for example, when we see a Batman movie, we might say, gee, this is definitely Frank Miller stream that's been, oh, this is an homage to Grant Morrison. Oh, this is the detective Batman of the 70s. And these are put in consciously and unconsciously. Can we make the same analogy from a Batman or comic book movie?
Yeah. In fact, this latest one, the Ant-Man movie, the business with Kang the Conqueror in the original, he's just he's a guy from the future, and he is a conqueror, and it's just him. They don't get into the multiverse thing at that time. This is back in the early 60s. But we find there's this interesting scene in one of the comics where he meets the Pharaoh Rama Tut, who was an early Fantastic Four villain. And the two get, one of them rescues the other from his apparent death in a previous issue. And they start talking and begin to wonder, are we the same man from two different points in the timeline? That doesn't exactly work, but it's pretty neat. Well, that's who you're seeing in the mid-credit scene. When we see a guy with this big headdress, that's Immortus, who was another version of Kang from the Avengers. And the guy with the Pharaoh's hat, that's Rama Tut. They're assuming you're a dyed-in-the-wool Marvelite, which, of course, I am. And so I get a huge kick out of this. And then these guys go into this stadium, like Joel Osteen's church, filled with other avatars of Kang. Where'd they get that? That comes from decades later, once they've introduced the multiverse thing. Didn't have anything to do with it originally. Plus the idea of this micro sub-universe, that comes from Brian Michael Bendis's last story arc in The Avengers, where we thought the Wasp had been killed, but it turns out, no, she was shrunk down to this micro level, and there she helped overthrow a tyrant. That's just grafted onto it, too, and pretty well. And then MODOK, he comes from a whole different continuity, and they make him into Yellowjacket. Did you see this? Did you say you've seen the movie yet?
I've read some spoilers because I screen the movie for the kids when it's their time. But no, keep going.
Yeah. Well, when MODOK, who is identified with the villain Yellowjacket, who was, of course, in the comics, just another super identity of Henry Pym. When they reveal that MODOK is this guy who he wasn't in the comics, and he finally turns against Kang and he says, at least I will have died as an Avenger. What sense did that make? Well, you have to know that for some years in the Avengers, Henry Pym was the Avenger Yellowjacket. It's like a wink to the reader, to the viewer. And so that's a good example of it. It's exactly as you say. They've taken bits and pieces from different continuities and characters and melded them into one story.
Yeah. Does the Council of Kangs ring a bell with another cartoon? Council of Rick?
Oh, Rick and Morty.
I've never seen that. I know of it. It's sort of based on Back to the Future, I think.
But it basically deconstructs all science fiction and comic book tropes. Huh. And so there's a Council of Ricks, which is very much
in the Citadel.
The Citadel of Ricks, yes.
Uh-huh.
Awesome. Yeah, well, we want to talk too about a lot of what you write, the Gnostic undertones and influences and all that, because that's definitely what the audience was. And I love, Bob, how you talk about the idea or the scholarship point that Gnosticism, to define it, you have to define it as a sort of, it really starts with theodicy, doesn't it? Like Jnana Yoga and Jainism and all that, right? It's people saying, all right, who's the Bond villain here? We can't, you know, what's going on kind of thing. Marvin Gaye, what's going on, right? So theodicy is a cornerstone of any Gnostic thought, and that helps explain other movements, like you say, like Lurianic Kabbalah, Mithraism, and so forth, right?
Yeah, any religion, though you feel alienated, especially Gnostic ones, from the world as it is, it's hard to believe that it is all inherently bad. I mean, it's hard to go that far. And so they will say, this could not be the creation of a good God, as other religions say it is. That something's wrong there. So what do we say? Well, there is an ultimate good God, but sure enough, he couldn't have created this world. So who did? Well, Plato had already distinguished between the one high God, the form of the good, and the demiurge, the craftsman who actually hands-on constructed the world. Well, he was no genius. It's like David Hume said once that, granted, there is a surprising amount of order in the world, but not enough to justify what Christians say about God. It's as if the Biden administration had created it, a committee of inept buffoons. And so that's that would explain it. And the like another version of this that apocalyptic Jews and Christians had was that God created it and Satan got a hold of it and ruined it. But one day God will take the reins again. It's a sort of an analogous view, though not the same one. And so the demiurge is at fault and we're implicated in it. Why aren't we acclimated to this kind of a world? Well, some people are, but some of us can see that this is wrong. Like Morpheus says to Neo, you feel like you don't really belong here, right? Well, yeah. Well, you don't. And here's why. The real you is the spark of the divine. Where'd you get that? It's part of God or of the realm of light in which he dwells. And I can show you how to isolate that and escape this veil of tears. So there is a world that is bad and you should be aloof to it and concentrate on getting back to the pleroma, the divine fullness. And so that's theodicy. You're clearing God of these charges, like a Job, you know, why is God doing what he's doing? It's the most profound book of the Bible. And at the end of it, God just says, hey, listen, Mr. Smart Guy, answer me this. What keeps the stars in the constellation of the Pleiades together? You got any ideas? Can you explain the migration of birds or this or that or the other thing that you can see? You don't know, do you? Well, no. And he says, and you think you can second guess me? I'm God. I created this stuff. You expect to be able to psych me out and hold me responsible? Forget it. And then Job says, once again, he says, I had heard of you, but now I close my mouth. I'm ashamed of what I said. And he never finds out what happened. And it's a rebuke. It's what Schleiermacher called agnostic piety, that sometimes you just have to say, look, who am I to think I can figure this out? That's idolatry. If I think I've got God figured out, I have reduced him to an idol. If an idiot like me can understand it, it can't be the real God. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of what Gnostics are saying, only they believe the knowledge is available. And which, of course, Hindus say that and others do. But it's not available to the common slob, the pew potato. And they may not even wonder why. It's all right. It's all right. Their religion is good as far as it goes. They just don't really understand what's going on, but they certainly are better off for believing in it. Unlike the real slobs, the two-legged animals out there that just don't give a damn. They're sadly irredeemable. But, you know, the pew potatoes, they're okay. They're okay. We got to be careful, because if they know what we think, they will persecute us, because they simply can't understand it, and you can't expect them to. It's not their fault, even. And I tend to think of Gnostic teachers as like Buddhist bodhisattvas. The New Testament casts them as arrogant SOBs. I have no need of you. Well, they might have been that way. It's possible, but I suspect that is projection from people that know there are those that make claims of higher knowledge and resent it. And you think you're better than us. Well, maybe they thought, well, I'm afraid I am in one sense, though it's nothing I can pat myself on the back for. And I think their idea was to be compassionate toward those. Like Nietzsche says, the real Superman doesn't disdain those who aren't on his level. Why should he be threatened by them? He's got to be careful with them, but he can't let them drag him down, but maybe he can drag them up.
Yeah, well said. Yeah, God bragging to Job reminds me, I don't know if you've seen the movie Zoolander, where Mugato is screaming, I invented the keyboard necktie. I invented the keyboard.
Yeah, I've never seen it.
Well, it's a funny movie. But yeah, it's interesting. But also, there's also the idea, too, that maybe God created a good world, but then his underlings just screwed things. The CEO is fine, but his underlings either rebelled or took over, like the Watchers and Paul, Powers and Principalities, his alter ego, Simon Magus, and these angels. That's another way to for theodicy, right, Bob?
Yeah, that goes back to these old views, probably derived from Plato, that there was a celestial creator, but that he begat gods who lived on earth among human beings and even created human beings. And that, however, there were some who taught things to humans that they shouldn't have. And that becomes the fallen sons of God who decided that earth girls are easy and seduced these women and taught them all kinds of stuff, like wearing makeup and gossiping and tricking their husbands and all that, and taught men the use of weapons and the like. That might have been okay for angels or demigods, but not for humans. And they didn't know what to do with it. And so it got so bad, God decided, I gotta drown them all like rats and start over. I'm sorry I made them if it's come to this. Of course, he didn't exactly make them. It was the fallen sons of God. And I think it's Psalm 82. It's part of the same mythology. God says, I say you are gods, all of you, yet you will die like men, like any mortal prince. You should have vindicated the widow and the orphan and all that. You didn't. And so for that, he sentences them to the underground realm, exactly like Zeus and the Titans. And that's why at the end it says they stumble around in darkness. It was an explanation for earthquakes. But nonetheless, it was like God fired them all. But this was and at the end it says, arise, O Yahweh, and rule the earth. That was the apocalyptic hope. it's careening out of control, not thanks to God, but thanks to his lieutenants. And he's given them the death sentence, but they're still in charge at the moment. The principalities and powers, the archons of this age, they're the fallen sons of God. And one day they will be kicked out of office, and may that day come soon. It was like a coherent view that explains why the world is such a wretched mess, but God is good. And as Peter Berger says, with this kind of theodicy, it's like it doesn't exactly explain what happens. I mean, it does, but it's not satisfying. You know, why did God allow them to do this? Well, it's not going to matter once he reverses it. Who's going to care if you're in heaven and everything's fine? Well, that's as much of a mystery as it ever was, but what the heck? I'm not God, but now it's everything's great, so what the heck?
Yeah, I agreed. And Vance, do you have a question or anything from the audience?
I don't see any questions so far, but I do have an observation, and I can put it in the form of a question. Isn't it true that all these models of God imagine God to have the same kind of single linear consciousness that we do? I mean, God's will, couldn't God do two wills at the same time and split off timelines and do all sorts of things? I mean, if he's not limited, but why does he always have to be like a superhuman, you know?
Have like the Council of Yahwehs, like the Council of Tanks and
Calvary. Well, I think of what Paul Tillich says, that if there is a God, God must be being itself, because if God were not, then God would not be ultimate. And by God, we mean the ultimate. Now, we can't describe that. It's no thing. It's not a being, even a supreme being. It's being itself. Yet that's pretty sterile as an object of worship. Right. And so we have to symbolize God according to the highest state of reality we know, which is personhood. So we should understand that God, like Tillich says, God is a person and the negation of himself as a person. And that to me is very much like Mahayana Buddhism and non-dualist Hinduism, where you're saying the ultimate Brahman is nirguna, without qualities. But we, on our lower level of knowledge, have to posit Brahma, a personal creator, who is Brahman saguna, with qualities. But that's a lower level, like a dreamlike level, higher than us, but it's the product of our limited perception. And so, as Spinoza said, to even speak of the will of God is mythological. To think that God has to think an ordered series of thoughts, which is what
exactly he's saying,
if God has plans or a will, that's mythical personalistic thinking. And so it can't really be that. You just have to try to keep straight that, yeah, this is not the absolute. It's kind of like John chapter 12. I love this passage where Jesus says to the crowd, whoever believes in me believes not in me, but in him who sent me. He doesn't say, don't believe in me, you're making a mistake. He says, keep in mind the perspective. You know, I am the way, not the goal. And that's kind of, or like the Zen thing, right? Hey, what is this moon I keep hearing people talk about? Oh, right there. Oh, your hand is the moon? No. I think that's profound, and they've discovered it in the East and the West. And so even to say God has competing wills, that would still be, that would sort of make him a multiple personality or a schizophrenic, as in a great story by Clark Ashton Smith called Schizoid Creator, where it turns out that God is the devil on his days off. It's really great. What a story. Love it. I used to read it in class to my students in Intro to Religion. Fascinating.
Great. Very good.
And I wanted to get also too into the origins of Gnosticism. And I know we've talked about it, but there's always new stuff. And you always bring new stuff too. And I think it's important. For example, Jane McGrath has done a lot of work, and he finds that the Mandeans, Bob, a lot of their terminology, what they name beings and other things, are from First Temple times. There's a kernel in the Mandean religion that goes way back. And then in History Valley, the podcast, Margaret Barker was there about 6 months ago, Bob. Mm-hmm. And she said that when she looks at the Gnostic Gospels and the Aeons and the Archons and their terminology, she sees them as coded, disguised angels and so forth from the days of Solomon. In other words, the Gnostics might have just been smuggling this sort of First mm-hmm. Temple, Asherah, animistic stuff, and they were able to do it underground, which makes their origins very ancient, don't you think? Have you heard anything of this? I know.
Oh, yeah, I'm a great believer in Margaret Barker's
work. She's rarely wrong, even with her gut. Even if her gut says something, she's right.
Yeah, and she says, for instance, that that Sophia is Asherah. Mm-hmm. Why do we have the fallen Sophia? Well, because Asherah was suppressed in Israel. Yet she continued. People won't give up what they sincerely believe in. It's like after Vatican II, traditionalist Catholics, they said, look, I'm sorry, but I'm still not eating meat on Friday. I'm sorry, I still believe in purgatory. You can't just change that. Or when Elijah Muhammad died, and his son, Warith Din Muhammad, changed everything up to make it more like Sunni Islam. It was predictable that somebody would do what Farrakhan did and said, hey, look, we were all just wrong before. No, I think you're wrong now. We're sticking with the old time religion. And and it's absolutely clear that that the Archons and so on are it's just a synonym for the fallen sons of God who still rule the nations. God, as in Deuteronomy 32, El Elyon, the Most High God, when he was separating the human race into nations, he said, well, okay, how many sons of God do we have here? I'll create that many nations so each will have a people to rule. And Yahweh, one of his sons, said, well, save Israel for me. And that's how it happened. But, you know, like Jephthah, when he's recruited to, I think, fight, who was it, the Ammonites or the Kryptonites or somebody, he offers a peace gesture. He says to the other king, look, why can't you be content with the land that your God, Chemosh, has given you, and we'll be content with what our God, Yahweh, has given us. Or David, he's driven out by Saul, and he has to work for the Edomites, and he says that I now can't worship Yahweh because I'm not in God's little acre of Israel. I'm in somebody else's little acre. Well, yeah, that's the way they viewed it. Or in Daniel, he's wondering why the heck isn't Michael, the angel, due on time. And he says, look, sorry, I'm late, but the prince of Persia, he intercepted me, and it took me a while to disengage. Now here I am. What is he talking about? Well, the god of the Persians, who is real and was appointed by El Elyon, he didn't get along with Yahweh and so forth. I mean, it all makes perfect sense. Those are the Archons, the powers behind the thrones. It's not even a reinterpretation. It's exactly the same thing. And Walter Schmidhals points this out. He says that Gnosticism and Jewish apocalyptic are basically the same thing. That is slightly in a different register, but basically it's even that's the same thing.
Agreed. And it's interesting, too, because this reminds me of many years ago, the debate you had with Bart Ehrman at the conference at Mythicist Milwaukee. And Bart was just dismissed you when you said talking about the he said it was outdated to believe in the Egyptian and Zoroastrian origins of Gnosticism. And don't get me wrong, Bart is an amazing scholar, and I've hung out with him, and he's a great guy to hang out.
Yes,
we had a social event, and he was not just cool, but he was really nice to my kids when they were toddlers. And you can't fake that. I mean, he's just he's a nice, intelligent man. However, I think I don't know why scholarship does that, but it is cool because you've always stood your ground. Like, no, these origins are essential. And now you have individuals like April DeConnick, David Litwa, other scholars who are saying, you know, it's so obvious that Gnosticism has a big Egyptian origin, ancient origin. It's like it's right in your face, isn't it, Bob?
Yeah. I mean, look at the Nag Hammadi texts. You've got Zostrianos. You've got the Apocalypse of Adam, which one anthroposophist scholar, I can't think of his name at the moment, shows is a Zoroastrian document, and that Jesus was just sort of added to the list of the illuminators, as they're called. And it just shows, like, everybody's got, like Kezeman said, that every sect can claim a plot of ground in the New Testament canon. That's why there was no church unity and can never be. Well, in the same way, look at the Nag Hammadi text. It's like every proposed theory of sources for Gnosticism was vindicated. Platonism, the Egyptian religion, Zoroastrianism, and Jewish apocalyptic, they're all in there. So, I mean, that's, I don't know how he can say that. I think he is, since he studied under the great Bruce Metzger, also a pleasure to know. I had a class with him once at Princeton. What a fine man. He was almost a fundamentalist in theology, and Bart studied textual criticism with him. And what turned Bart away from the faith was theodicy. Something that might well do that. But the fact is that it seems to me that everything he says shows that he's still captive to the evangelical paradigm about authorship dates and things like that. Not completely. He's like, fundamentalists will not admit Jesus is pictured as an apocalyptic failed prophet. He'll go along with that, to his credit. That is a strong view. But certain things he seems never to have heard of, like the idea that Paul might not have written Galatians. Well, Karl Barth's mentor, Rudolf Steck, believed that. He wasn't some kind of wacko Jehovah's Witness or something. Or the idea that there were a bunch of Greco-Roman novels that involved people being crucified or condemned to it, but escaping in the final reel, as they say, and that people discovered empty tombs where somebody had been buried alive accidentally. He said, there are no such novels. I'm sorry, but there are. You can read them in B.P. Reardon's Collected Ancient Greek Novels.
And you talk a lot about them in your book, your new book.
Yeah. How can you not know about this? Well, because they're just not in the box. And that is startling, because Bart is brilliant. There's some of his books that I love. He just, the stuff is strange and unknown, apparently, to him. I hate to say that, because I don't want to sound like I'm more negative toward him than I am. I'm simply trying to explain surprising differences I find that I have with him, but I don't mean to denigrate him.
Oh, no worries, you aren't. And what about the idea, as April de Koenig said, that one thing that's elusive about Gnosticism is that it's more of a metaphysical orientation, or you can, as some have said, you can compare it to shamanism. Shamanism is a spiritual modality that attaches itself to Mongols and the Lam in different groups and then spread down into the Middle East. So you can't have a church of the shamanism, but you can have a religion with a shamanistic side. Gnosticism is kind of that way. And some have said even Buddhism is kind of sort of this parasitic religion that can just fit into Chinese, Japanese, you know what I mean? It can adapt like the Holy Plasmate of Philip K. Dick. What do you think of that, Bob?
Well, I did an article once called Buddhism and Bultmannism, where I said that Buddhism is a great example of what Bultmann's talking about, that this existentialist understanding of reality that is magnified into colorful mythology. Well, that's what Buddhism does. They don't care what gods you believe in, as long as you realize that they're not really the ultimate thing, and so on. Whether it has to do with shamanism, I don't know, because one big question remaining for me with Gnosticism is, what sort of transformative experience did people have? Because a lot of what they say about enlightenment and so on sounds to me like they have simply embraced a doctrine and have a knowledge of new things. Like, okay, when I die, I memorize the passwords, like you said. I'm pretty sure that's why the Dead Sea Scrolls had their members memorizing the names of the angels, because one day they would need them. Oh, you're Zariel. That's right. Come on in. It seems to me that's like you had a kind of knowledge that you thought anyway. And I compare this to Jnana Yoga of Shankara and so on, where he led people to believe you would have this transformative, mind-blowing experience. But most people, all you needed to do was to understand his doctrine. Well, people said, you know, I think I grasp this, but I'm no different. I'm not experiencing anything. I guess I'm just hoping for the best once I die. Some people must have had it. I mean, Shankara and a lot of people have these fantastic experiences. I have a hunch they're somehow manipulating temporal lobe, whatever, some lobe. I used to know what it was. And they're getting this oceanic feeling, which is exactly what Freud said mysticism was. But the same thing apparently happened with Shankara. His followers began to say, maybe it isn't that much like lightning striking. Maybe there are mantras and things, some kind of yoga that will make this happen. And Schmidthal said the same thing about Gnosticism. He said it went from a simple Satori kind of a thing to sort of superstitious stuff like knowing the names and all of that. And people that had to do that, I think, were sort of admitting defeat, that there wasn't any lightning bolt involved. Or Buddhism, Zen, right? You got the two schools of it. It just has to hit you. You can't cause it. And others say, well, I'm not going to wait around forever. Is there some koan or something I can use? That's a perennial problem, I think. And so I'm sorry to get off on that, but my point was, I wonder how many people actually felt some sort of transcendent opening up, and how many simply embraced a new theology that they thought would get them somewhere. I don't know if there's any way to know.
No, indeed.
Yeah, it's a good question.
And Yeah, before we move on to some questions, and it's interesting because you and I, Bob, have talked about how they've tried to marginalize Gnosticism and never exist and blah blah. We've beaten that dead horse a lot, but also I didn't know too from your book. You say there are scholars who are trying to say that the mystery religions never existed either. Speaking of another spiritual modality, that's what do you think?
Yeah, Helmut Kester said that in his two-volume thing about the basically his theology of the New Testament, some other title. And he said, really, what did they have in common? And it seemed to me that he was grossly oversimplifying it to the point where you could say the Southern Baptists or Ralph Cramden's Raccoon Lodge was a mystery religion, and that therefore there really weren't any. I don't buy that for a second. Because the Mithras and Isis, we know from ancient works that they had analogous initiation rites and had visions, at least some of them, and that they had sacramental rituals where you were patched into the saving sacrifice of the god who had a victory, who may have died and come back to life or gone to the underworld and come back. It's all like different versions of the same thing. And that there was a period of catechism and preparation. Right. There was a holy meal. There were things like in the Hercules religion, you would wear a lion skin as part of the initiation because you were repeating Hercules' killing of the Nemean lion and so on. I don't see how you can ignore that stuff, but they don't seem to, they must have been absent playing hooky on the day somebody explained what an ideal type was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know they're not all the same. They're not just Xeroxed from each other. The point is, let's make an admittedly artificial list of what they do have in common and use that as a yardstick to measure their variations from it. We can, like with Buddhism, is Buddhism a religion? Well, I'm not so sure because they don't have God. Yeah, but look at what they do have, and that may explain why they differ in this area. And of course it does, because Buddhism says, there are gods, but they're just like angels or something. They can't help you. You have to do it. Well, bingo, that may be why they don't have a god. and so I don't see what is so impossible to grasp about that. But if there was no such thing as Gnosticism, you might as well say there's no such thing as Presbyterianism. I mean, there's loads of different Presbyterian nuances. I just think that is inexplicably dim-witted. And the reason I say inexplicably is that people like Helmut Kester, Karen King, people I have known personally, I know they're brilliant. And that this intellectual fad just puzzles the heck out of me.
Same here, same here. All right, before we get some questions, a little housekeeping. God, I lost my notes. Yeah, for the intro, you heard the Virtual Alexandria Academy. Please join. I just added a course on Mary Magdalene, the characteristics of Mary Magdalene. And yeah, you had 25, I think it's 20% off this weekend, but I'll put it on the show notes. Anybody looking for voiceover services, I am your man, ramping that up, and it's doing well. Also, I'll put that on the show notes too. Lots of links, great shows coming in the future, and we'll get into that, including we'll have in about a week or so a show on Simon Magus versus Simon Peter, things that, the great battle in ways that you haven't seen it. So we'll have Elliot Saxton, and he's going to come up with a good presentation. So great shows coming, and appreciate the support, and definitely also support Bob and his Patreon, so he brings you some very cool articles in Bible Geeks. So that's the housekeeping. Events, any questions from you or the audience?
Well, I got the first one on my list is, I guess we don't have to address this in large terms, but Wojciech Habdas wants to know why Gnostics are so beautiful.
They are.
No, I don't know. I just put that out there to see how you react.
I'm sorry for the stereotyping, but this makes me think of the question of who is a Satanist, and it's you tend to think it's a bunch of losers who are some kind of pathetic nerds, and probably are, according to the standards of the world, are probably not the beautiful people. Though LaVey did have some pretty decent looking women to be his alters, but I don't know. What they say is so fascinating, and it is elitist. But I think that's simply an accurate description of people. You don't have to be a jerk about it, but.
Well, if Helen of Tyre was an incarnation of Helen of Troy, I'm sure she was very nice on the eyes. Right. And Simon Magus was proud to walk around with her hand on his arm. So,
his trophy logos.
All right. John D. Thackeray wants to know, this is more like a Bible geek question. When Jesus refers to himself as Morning Star in Revelation, is he saying sweet Jesus is going to return as bitter?
You mean
that's well,
the Morning Star? It seems to be a reference to this is slim pickings, but that sounds like a reference back to Isaiah 14, where the king of Tyre is compared to Adam who was cast out of Eden and all that, which is kind of odd. But the book of Revelation is filled with astronomy and astrology to an amazing degree. If anybody wants to follow up on this, Bruce J. Molina wrote a terrific book called, I believe it's, I always get the title and the subtitle mixed up. It's something like the genre and message of Revelation. I couldn't have that turned around. It might be the message and genre. But Molina is M-A-L-I-N-A. He's famous for having done a bunch of stuff on sociology and anthropology in the Gospels, which is very illuminating. But this book, there's a surprising amount of stuff still extant from ancient astronomy and astrology, which were the same thing back then. And he shows how this, that, and the other thing, all through Revelation, they're using well-known, widely attested images from ancient astronomy. It clears loads of things up, the trumpets, the 24 elders, all kinds of things, the living creatures that are full of eyes, and more and more and more. You got to read it. Well, given that, there's nothing sinister about the Morning Star with Jesus, but he's being shown as fitting into the message in the heavens. And when people even today wonder, the woman clothed with the sun, is that supposed to be the Virgin Mary? Well, that's possible. I mean, there's two or three good possibilities, but that's the kind of thing. I forget what he says specifically about that, but that's the kind of thing that with which the book of Revelation is just dripping. And so Jesus is the Morning Star. That wasn't necessarily a predicate of just demons, because after all, in the first couple of centuries, you had bishops named Lucifer. Right. They you don't have a bishop Satan anywhere. So Lucifer meant different things. And with Jesus, too, I'm sure they're saying he's like the son of the morning and so on.
OK, great. Here's a SD wanted to observe that we haven't mentioned Manichaeism yet in this broadcast. What do you have to say about the Manichaeism and how it fits in with this latest concept of yours in the book?
Well, by that time, like, Manichaeism was pretty syncretistic, so it would almost be surprising if it were mainly influenced by one of these views. But in a sense, you can pinpoint, it certainly comes out of Gnosticism. It's like a more developed version of Gnosticism, which is saying something, because it's in astonishingly complex even before you get to that in the third century. And for instance, Mani, who styled himself the apostle of Jesus Christ, he taught that he was the current incarnation of the Paraclete and of the same entity that had appeared as Jesus, as the Buddha and Zoroaster. He knew all about him. Of course, it was a very cosmopolitan age. And he had this cosmic dualism that some people compare to Zoroastrianism. But it was more of an antagonistic dualism, though it's pretty tough to beat the Zoroastrians with that. But one of my favorite scholars, I don't know if I'm saying this right, the Swedish scholar, Geo Widengren, Widengren, he wrote a bunch of books, including Mesopotamian elements in Manichaeism. And this guy, it was omniscient. Whenever I get to thinking, you know, Price, you're pretty smart, I think, nah, because there's this guy and that guy and the other ones that know more than I can have learned in 100 lifetimes. Well, he's one of those. And he shows how not only was Marduk probably originally a dying and rising god, but that survives intact into the redeemed redeemer myth of Gnosticism and Manichaeism. He doesn't just tie it to Gnosticism, but as far as Manichaeism, and Manichaeism was a world religion for nearly 1,000 years. It's amazing. Yeah. We look at it like some kind of obscure cult, a bunch of savages dancing around a fire. No. It just shows you what can happen after a long, long time.
The Tesla of religions, right?
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, that always amazed me too. Now, a pack of viceroys wanted to know if you had any thoughts on the work of Professor Robin Faith Walsh. He just bought that book.
Yeah, that's an interesting book. I think in a way she's reinventing the wheel, because she's arguing that these were literary compositions. They weren't just put together by a bunch of pious rubes. And I don't mean to make her sound dismissive, but she's saying, given literacy rates and all of that, and the availability of writing materials and all that, it can't have been anything like today. And that there's enough polish in the Gospels to show that they were written by, how do you say it, literati or whatever, that people that knew each other and would get together to share their works and all that. Well, for my money, the Old Testament minimalist Philip R. Davies had already shown that about the Old Testament books. He said, who do you think wrote this stuff and for whom? Well, look at the subtleties that redaction criticism, for example, shows, that you could do what Conselman did and compare Luke with Mark and collected these little changes that aren't that little in accumulation. You can see this guy had an agenda. He's subtly altering what Mark said, and it's pretty clear what he's getting at. Like, you would never have that stuff if you weren't an advanced scholar writing for your colleagues. Do you think the common people that heard bits and pieces of these texts read in church every once in a while, could you expect them to pick up on this? And they weren't stupid, but they simply wouldn't have had the opportunity. Well, I think that he had already basically said what she's saying. She's just talking more about the New Testament and the Hellenistic context. But so I think she's right. I'm a big history of scholarship guy, and I think it's worth pointing out that Davies had, as if I understand everybody, had already made that case. But that's good. I mean, that's like she seems not to know about that, as I remember. But that's good, because it's like repeatability in science. So I think it's a real good book.
Okay, great.
She is against the idea, I believe, of communities. You know, the standard that there was a Johannine community and a Thomas community and a Mary community. What do you think of that, Bob? Do you think?
I don't see that that's entailed there, because you don't have to assume that everybody understood everything, but for the intelligentsia who did study, the complexity of the text taught them things that would affect what they taught the common people. Other things they would have thought, well, for the Sukekoi, you know, why bother them with this? but they would know it. And so I don't think that the work that has been done on that basis seems to me to make a whole lot of sense. And if you say that, if you take Eric Franklin's Christ the Lord, where he's trying to explain a shift in eschatology, sort of the same thing Conselman did, but taking it a little further, trying to situate it in view of the delay of the parousia and God vindicating his faithful. And it makes sense. It's the kind of thing that we know faced early Christians. And if he can show how these one book is more germane to one kind of situation or another, that's a pretty strong theory. I don't think it's an either or thing.
Yeah, it makes sense. All right, Vince, one more question.
Oh boy, I got to pick somebody's question. Okay, we have a Cathar question. We have a general consciousness question, and we have something about the Aura Linda.
No, that's not that's like a request, not a question.
All right. Yeah. Okay. We'll get rid of that one. Okay. So let's see. I'll pick the Catharism. What are your thoughts on Catharism in general? And Jose R. says that he says there's still a church active in France, I believe. But what are your thoughts?
Well, that was one of these so-called medieval Manichaean groups that we don't know if they reinvented the wheel or if there was some underground trend, which either is likely. And it did have cosmic moral dualism like historic Manichaeanism. It might have been a continuation of it. And one thing I find very interesting is that they, as Gnostics, they held a view that is also held by Jainists and others further east, and they pursued it to the same logical conclusion independently of one another, namely that once you were done with worldly existence and you had freed yourself from it, you might as well voluntarily starve to death. Both of them came up with that. And so
you don't think the Manichaeans could have been the bridge, because the Manichaeans,
oh, they might have been.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just speculating.
Yeah, the Bogomils, a bunch of these people were dualists, the Paulicians, and it could well have been that they passed down old manuscripts and so on. there's a good discussion of this in Ioan Culiano's book, The Tree of Gnosis, where he says you got two possibilities. There's dissemination, where they did actually have links to the past, or structuralism. The human mind has pretty much got the same furniture in it. No matter where you are, you're living in the same kind of world. And sooner or later, religious people will settle on one of a range of options. And so it's not surprising if they do reinvent the wheel. It's hard to tell which happened.
Absolutely.
By the way, I have a book I'm working on. It's basically finished, but I'm tinkering, called Houses of the Holy, a higher critical survey of the world religions, where I have chapters, some extremely long, some very short, on the well-known religions. And about half of the ones are so-called lesser religions, like the Baha'is, the Mandeans, the Yazidis, so forth. And so I go with how they, you know, how did they begin? How did their theology develop? What are the big factions? And of course, there's plenty of jokes thrown in. what are the Muslims doing with this problem, or are they up Shiite Creek? ecumenically insensitive remarks. So it's going to be great.
Sounds like a good textbook, you know, for a, you know, survey religion course in colleges.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, but I'm trying to be like, the problem with stuff like Houston Smith's The Religions of Man, or whatever they're calling it, The Religion of Hominids, or whatever these days, that they tend to oversimplify, and that's okay, because they're introductions to religion.
Yeah,
that's all right. I don't blame them, but I'm writing for people that, like me, are interested in the weird aspects, the minutia, the odd questions. So let's tackle them, and I think it's going to be a unique treatment.
Sounds great.
Very excited about that one. Awesome. Awesome. Well, there's so much more for the audience in this book. As I always say, we scratch the surface. I love how I was reading your book, Bob, and I was like, why were people in ancient times so interested in empty tombs and pirates? That seems to be a thing. Again, I'm thinking of that movie, Shakespeare in Love, where his colleagues are hounding Shakespeare. He wants to do something artistic, and they're like, it's got to have pirates. If it doesn't have pirates, nobody will buy it. So pirates was very, I mean, we make fun of how Hollywood is always coming up with the same tropes, but in ancient times, they had the same agents, right? Got to have pirates.
Well, of course.
You want pirates.
It was common to have people buried alive. It happened so often that medical textbooks said, now watch out. You may better make darn sure, because, you know, here's case after case. And this comes up in nonfiction works, as well as medical texts and so on. So it happened quite a bit. Yeah, we're still in doubt, right? If somebody's brain dead, are they dead? You know, what constitutes? So we still have that problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. The old, same as it ever would. Same as it ever was. There I am. Mm-hmm. Quoting the song wrong. So, well, awesome. So you got that book there for your book found. You just, mindvendor.com. Can people, do you still promote your homepage as much as you do, or what do you want to promote?
Yeah, it's in the works, but it's still functional. I mean, we're revising it, but yeah. And I don't know if we've done it again. For a while, we had the link, so you could order it right from there, from Amazon. Then idiots that run our state made that illegal, but now it's legal again. So I think we have that up and running again.
All right. Well, we'll have it on the show notes. It looks like I'm turning into Max Headroom again. I don't know why it happens with my camera it happens always after an hour and 15 minutes. But awesome. Well, the audience, great questions, great discussions. First, I'll say, Vance, thanks for taking this pirate ship where it needs to go.
Arr, me babies. We have Captain Bible Geek on at the wheel. So, no, it's hey, Bob, it's been great being with you, and thanks you for coming on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, Bob, as always, thank you for gracing the virtual Alexandria, the priests of the Temple of Syrinx. They are cowling. They are afraid. The Archons run. They are running because we got their passwords. We're there.
Yeah. Hallelujah.
Well, thank you, Bob. Thank you, audience. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And as I always say, write your own gospel, live your own myth, and have a good rest of your weekend. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Amen.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.